Have you ever thought about that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? I did. I actually bought two homes in Albuquerque that I Airbnb'd, and it was just an amazing investment, honestly, because, you know, as you are accruing value in your property, you are also making money on the Airbnbs. It's amazing. So your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
21 Seeds infused tequila is a must-have. It's an award-winning tequila. It's infused with real juice, with real fruit, which means the flavors are built in. It's real. So you need like two or three ingredients to make your perfect cocktail. Hey, you know how I'm always trying to keep my house parties exciting? New cocktails? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's something that's going to flip the script.
Okay.
All right, 21 Seeds infused tequila.
Yeah. Tell me more about this, right? Oliver Hudson.
Yeah, 21 Seeds is an award-winning tequila that's infused with juice from real fruits. You only need two to three ingredients to make the perfect cocktail.
Wait a minute. I think I know what brand you're talking about. You know why?
Yeah.
Because 21 Seeds is founded by two sisters and their friend. It's female founded.
That's right.
See?
Sounds
See
like
how I know? Something I can get behind.
I know. Well, there's a good story behind that for sure. Listen, if you love tequila, you have to try 21 Seeds infused tequila. Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling revelry.
No, no.
Sibling revelry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling revelry.
That's good. Oliver.
Sibling revelry.
Gotta harmonize. Gotta harmonize on that.
You know, I've never been good at I can't figure it out.
Because
why?
It's because
always want to match.
Yeah, that's what happens. That's the hard thing about harmonizing.
Yeah.
Here, you start singing like
just like bee.
No. Sing like yesterday.
Yesterday. All my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
I was doing terrible, too. I was like, what am I doing? I was like, where am I going with this harmony? Or do Blackbird. Blackbird
singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life.
Hold on. What's the harmony, babe?
You were only...
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Ready, go.
You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light of the cold, dark night.
We gotta work on it. I need to work on my harmonies. What's happening here? Okay, Ollie, this is our first episode of the season.
Yeah, and we have seasons now.
I'm excited about our season.
We got picked up for another season.
We picked ourselves up.
That's right. It's the beauty of being your own network.
Oh my God, it's true. And so we picked ourselves up. Here we are. Mm-hmm. And so we have some amazing people this season.
Mm-hmm.
And
we're kicking it off with
one of my favorites I think we've ever done.
Me too.
Ron and Clint Howard. First of all, I didn't even realize that they were related.
I know you didn't. I did.
You knew. I didn't know that they were related, which is weird because we've known Ron Howard
And then you show
our whole
and then
lives.
You see who Clint Howard is, and you're like, oh, this, like, is the guy in every movie.
Every
ever.
Movie that you've right, ever seen.
Yeah.
And it was so nice to get to know them as siblings. It was like really kind of a wonderful hour and a half that we had. We've known Ron Howard since we were kids. Mm-hmm. He directed Backdraft with our dad. Ron Howard is one of the most prolific and talented and legendary directors, mm-hmm. with some of the great movies. Yeah.
One
of which is one of our favorites, which is Parenthood.
Parenthood.
Which
amazing.
Is like hands down one of my favorite
Still
movies.
To this day, mm-hmm. every piece of that movie is just perfect. It's timeless, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And Ron, when you go through his credits, just IMDb him.
It's unbelievable.
You almost forget what he's done.
Yeah.
And then you look at it like, oh shit, he did this and this. And I mean, it's crazy.
Being a child actor, it's something that him and our pa, Kurt, have in common, which is really growing up in the business and like talking about it from his perspective, mm-hmm. and what that was like for him. I mean, it's really interesting.
Oh gosh, yeah. And you know, Clint too, by the way. Clint was also a childhood star.
Yeah, and in those days, obviously, there were only how many...
Oh my God, there was three networks.
Channels. I mean, people, you had five channels.
CBS,
you know,
ABC.
So, yeah. So when someone was watching... Well, we get into that in the episode. Right. Ron talks about that. But I don't know. It was just so fascinating. He's also just the most lovely man.
Oh my God.
He's the kindest, sweetest, most generous... Man,
I tried to, you know, pitch myself to him. I want to be in one of his movies. But they also wrote this book together, which is so great.
They did, yeah.
As brothers wrote a book together. It's called The Boys.
They were talking about how they were sort of memoirs and a shared perspective of their childhood and sort of looking
and their parents.
I know their parents
were awesome.
So great.
I mean, my gosh.
What an amazing.
Yeah, just this free. Anyway, you'll listen to it. But, you know, they managed their money, but they were beautiful with it. I mean, it was just this, it seemed like this beautiful, creative upbringing.
For me, what really happened in this, and I hope it happens to you guys who are listening, I got really inspired by his life story.
Mm-hmm.
He's so brilliant in what he does. And he absolutely loves it so much. Mm-hmm. You know, when he talks about it and he's talking about making movies and his experiences, it's like you just want to get on a movie set, write a script, start. You just want to do it.
I know.
You know,
I wonder what Ron Howard is like when he's not getting what he wants, because he's so sweet. And he's so compassionate.
You should have asked him.
Do you think he would ever be like, God damn it, I just want him. I can't see him doing that.
I don't
that.
Think that's the way. I think Ron's like even, like
pretty
real
even
Steven.
Yeah.
So, which to me is such an amazing, like shows so much character. Like that, to have that characteristic, to not be reactive.
We're also dealing with egos, you know, and actors and all the crap that comes along with that. And,
that's true.
You know, do you think Steven Spielberg is even Steven? What happens to the Stevens that aren't even, you know, like there's so many Stevens, Stephen King.
Steven Spielberg is even Steven.
Probably even Steven.
Well, glad we had this.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Anyway, enjoy Ron and Clint Howard.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
It's so good to see you.
Likewise. I kind of forgot it was you doing this. That's fantastic. Thank you, guys.
I love that. That's the best thing. I forgot it was you guys.
What's up, hee-hee boy?
Hi. Yeah,
that's me.
Oh, I'm so happy you guys are doing this, and I can't wait to talk about how you grew up and everything, because it's just so fascinating, but also just that you wrote a book about being siblings, which... is something Oliver and I talk about, which is why we started the podcast, which is that it's a relationship people don't really delve into that much.
Well,
excuse me real quick. How close are you guys age-wise?
Almost three.
Yeah, two and a half.
Two and three quarters.
Okay. Listen, real quick. You know, Ron and I's split of being 5 years.
Okay.
From my perspective, was just beautiful. Because I always looked at him and said, no, I could not kick his ass. I better not try. Mm-hmm. But I can only imagine if it was only, I had some friends that had, that their siblings were 2 years apart. And it was, you know, there was always that little bit of jockeying. And yeah. Ron and I just never had it. Some of it has to do with him. What? And some of it has to do with the 5 year spread.
And so then also probably your upbringing and your parents and the way that you were raised.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, I mean, you know, we didn't set out to write about our relationship particularly, but of course that inevitably became a part of it, as you know, as you guys are saying. And but you know, we would fight, and Clint was tougher than he's given himself credit for, to the point where even though I was 5 years older, every once in a while I felt like I got to give a little back here because I'm feeling this a little more than I should. And you know, it would get a little intense, and Dad would grab us. And, you know, and he'd basically say, look, you guys are brothers. You're always going to be brothers, but you have a chance to be friends for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really something valuable. And I hope you'll hear me and take it seriously and do right by each other.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I have three kids and my two boys are the oldest and they're about 2.5 years apart and they do get along, mm-hmm. but there is one's 14 now and one's 11. So that separation is kind of happening. And I give them the same speech when they're getting on each other, mm-hmm. or my older one is on top of my little one and not including him. I'm like, look, this is it, you guys. This is it. This is the most important relationship that you're going to have. And of course, I don't think they hear me because they're like, whatever, Dad, you know.
I think we kind of heard it. I mean, we may not have heard it then, but I think it, you know, it echoes. And that's what I think being a good parent offers. You don't necessarily always get the satisfaction of the acknowledgement at that moment.
Right. But,
you know,
but it seeps in. Yeah.
You know, I've said this all my life. First of all, Dad was very methodical when he spoke. And a lot of times I that would drive me crazy, but it wasn't what he said. It was the way he said it. You know, he just had that way of connecting with me. You know, he had that way of gaining my attention, not in a going to slap you way, although he did thump. My dad mm-hmm. was a thumper. He beat
him. Oh, like, hard fingernail.
Oh, son of a bitch. And, it hurt like a son of a bitch.
Well, it didn't even really hurt, but it just reverberated around in there. You know, and it made you sort of pause and think.
And he'd show it. He'd show it.
Yeah.
He would show it. But anyway.
Well, before we get into, like, you know, your childhood, why did you guys want to write this book? It's a little bit different. You know what I mean? Writing about being siblings.
How did it come about?
Yeah.
There are a couple things that came together, but you start. Clint.
Well, listen, you know, we both have this just amazing amount of love for our parents. I love my dad so, so amazingly deeply. And, you know, I don't know whether I showed it in his life. I think I did. I think I was a good son. I was a good son, as you know, to the best of my ability. But given this opportunity to really lay the cards on the table, to lay the truth on the table, you know, so it's not hearsay. It's not secondhand. You know, we got to tell the story, and it's stories I've been telling to anyone who would listen for years. It's just, you know, Ron and I had an opportunity to write a book, and, you know, writing a book is fun. I really enjoyed it.
You know, people have always asked me, you know, and Clint, you know, what was it like growing up on TV? What was it like being a child star? You know, that's just kind of a standard question and, you know, kind of a hard one to answer because that's my reality. I don't know anything else, but, one day I was hanging around we were shooting or something, somewhere and I was directing Tom Hanks. And he's an author and an avid reader. Yeah, that guy. And I said, Tom, people are coming to me and saying I should do a memoir. What do you think? I'm very reluctant. He said, you probably ought to one of these days. But if I were you, I would just do it about your childhood. because that's what everybody wants to know about. And that's what's really, really unusual about your life is that you not only succeeded, but you survived. And of course, he liked hearing those stories whenever we were hanging out. So when mom passed first, 17 years later, dad passed, and we were there. We were at the house in Toluca Lake, preparing for dad's memorial service, and which we'd also done with dad for mom. But now that there we were, looking at photos and so forth, and reminiscing a lot about our journey and how much they meant to that, and how brilliant they were at the particulars of kind of raising child actors. And I told Clint what Hanks had told me. And I said, Tom thinks that's the story. I said, if I would never do it on my own, to be honest, but if you wanted to do this with me together, I think we could write about them. We could write about mom and dad, and we could also answer that question that we've heard all our lives in an entertaining and honest ways. And that might be very unusual. And I really, from that point forward, I really stuck to the idea that, no, I don't want to do it on my own, but I'd love to do it with Clint. And when we sat down, we worked on our book proposal, thoroughly for quite a while. When we started to take it around to publishers, I really felt like we were onto something. And I think they realized as well, because the big thing was we didn't have to agree on a damn thing because we were going to each contribute to this. And where there were differences, that would be, interesting to people, I thought.
Did you have those moments where your perspectives were just so completely different that it was like, what?
Yeah,
like,
different perspective of the same scenario.
I think we had to remind each other from time to time that, my chair was completely different. My chair in the late 60s and early 70s, I had a completely different view of things than Ron had. Ron was, that spread of being, 14 and 9. That was a big spread. Ron was, a lot more aware. Like, Ron remembers the Charlie Manson murders, Sharon Tate, the Tate-LaBianca murders. And that's just a blur to me. I mean, I kind of can vaguely remember the headlines. And I remember Steve Railsback doing that great TV movie, but I don't remember that. But yet, so Ron had a, more mature, being older, he had a more mature perspective of things. And from time to time, I would remind Ron, hey, bud, I was a little kid at this point,
Yeah. And I was always a little more of a worrier, a little more kind of serious about things and there were times, especially there's a chapter where we write about kind of the only time when we saw real marital friction in our parents and it seemed dangerous, that it seemed like divorce could occur. Didn't. And it was only a day, but to us it was seismic because they didn't fight. We never saw that.
Right.
And I remembered that as a really heavy memory. Clint kind of recalls it as a little funny.
Yeah.
Kind of amusing almost. And I was surprised by that. But there are other, other versions of that too.
Yeah, your parents' names Gene and Rance.
Yes.
Rance is such an interesting name. Is that an Irish thing?
He made it up.
Okay.
He made that name up. and in the book we sort of talk a little bit about, we surmise maybe where he might have found it, because his given name was Harold Beckenholt. He was a farm boy living in Oklahoma and Kansas. His parents would buy, fix up, and sell farms. And that was his childhood. He lived on three different farms back and forth between Kansas and Oklahoma.
And wasn't it actually Aunt Glee, a dad's sister, that sort of helped us piece together how he picked the name Rance? Because dad never told us. Dad never, he never said, this is why I landed on.
He didn't like to talk about it. He didn't like it if I would even mention to anybody that he had changed his name. No, I'm Rance Howard. I'm acting. I'm out there every day. And we don't need to confuse those sons of bitches.
So he changed his name. Your mom was Jean. That wasn't a change.
She was Jean Spiegel. And he was Harold Beckenhold, and they fell in love that way.
How did they meet?
They were teenagers, right?
Well, they met at my mom had gone. she had the acting bug, and she came from a small town, but her family was well regarded. They had, her father was named Butch Spiegel, because he was the butcher. His real name was Bill, but he went by Butch. Her mom was very artistic, very, very creative, great with her hands, but very introverted. Mom had his sort of joie de vivre, and he also turned out to be kind of the lovable town drunk in a way, but that, you know, that's in the DNA there. But she had the dream, and early enough at 17, she got accepted at the New York City Academy for Performing Arts, which was a pretty big deal. And she went. The parents, they let her go right out of high school.
And Duncan, Oklahoma was a
That's huge. Yeah.
Well, she had that kind of vision. And look, we didn't give mom enough credit. I mean, we did in the book. It was an opportunity. While she was alive, one of my little regrets is I don't think I gave her enough of a sense of my understanding that our family journey had every bit as much to do with her. And they transformed the course of their lineage and the future through their decisions. But she had this impetus. She went, unfortunately, 6 months into her work there, she was hit by a truck, nearly died. And, you know, brought back to Duncan. My grandmother had a kind of a psychic event where she just knew. She just woke up in the middle of the night and said, Jean's in trouble. She's been hurt. Mm. And it turned out that was just the time she'd been hit by the truck, you know, and she got the call a few hours later.
Wow.
But she came back. She survived. It was touch and go. She survived. And, you know, she still had the dream of acting, but they weren't going to send her to New York anymore. So she went to the University of Oklahoma, which right after World War II, already had a reputation as a really good theater school, mostly musical theater, not movies particularly, but they had a good program. They sent her there. And my father had this dream. You know, he grew up, he was thought of himself as a cowboy. He wanted to either be a heavyweight boxer or a singing cowboy. Mm-hmm. He wasn't good enough to be a heavyweight fighter, and he couldn't carry a tune, but he had big ideas. And his idea...
Clearly your parents are perfect for each other.
Yes.
Like, right off the bat. Yeah.
They discovered that pretty well. Anyway, he thought that he would graduate from high school and get on his horse.
Lucky.
And ride to Los Angeles. Lucky his horse. He would camp along the way. He would ride along the highways. He would follow the same path that that all the Okies followed to try to get to Los Angeles.
That's great.
And he would ride his horse there and ride down Hollywood Boulevard and so show those sons of bitches what a real cowboy looked like. and that was what he was going to do. And he didn't have a great relationship with his father. Who mostly wanted him as the oldest son to stick around and run the farm. But no, his mom understood, but said, I don't think riding the horse to Hollywood is the right idea, Harold. But you can go to college over here. And they teach acting, I think. He went there. Do you guys know the TV and movie actor, but mostly TV actor Dennis Weaver?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was McCloud and Gunsmoke and all that.
Yeah.
He played my dad in Gentle Ben.
Oh, right. He did. That's
oh,
right.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Of course.
He was a couple of years older, but he was at OU and introduced them in a scene study class that he was sort of, as a senior, he was kind of conducting this class, introduced them. They fell in love. They didn't make it. They made it through that semester that year, but they ran off. And, they didn't quite tell us the story, but years later we figured it out that they were the runaway bohemians.
Wow.
Man.
Oh, fun. And then they went off. Did they go immediately to LA or did they go to New York?
First they went to Nashville. They got wind that there was someone in their sphere that had successfully managed to grab some acting work in Nashville in the little theater area they had. And so mom and dad went to Nashville and they struck out. They didn't have any luck in Nashville. And having gone from Oklahoma to Nashville, they then just, they moved up north to New York City. So they landed in New York City. They spent the first 4 or 5 years of their
40s.
In the 40s.
Yeah, in New York City.
Yeah, wow. Late 40s. 48. Wow. 47, 48.
So you guys had no choice. I mean, this was
in, yeah, just in your DNA.
You had no choice.
I know what that feels like.
You know, they got married and they miraculously, eventually got married. They miraculously, you know, survived in the business. And my dad was thrilled. He said, you know, from the age of 20 on, he never had to have a real job. He always managed to do this for a living. She wanted to act and was very, very good by all accounts, but hated the competition, didn't fit. You know, she wasn't quite the character, wasn't quite the leading lady, didn't quite get the work. But and when I was born, she signed off once and for all. I'm not going to act anymore. But.
Right. And then the second you started crawling, they're like, he's auditioning.
Not really.
Future fitness,
it's
Ollie.
The future. It's the future of fitness, and it's happened to be called future fitness. Yes, this is something that I have been using for a year and a half now, and it is possibly the greatest workout app that I have ever been a part of.
Well, here's what I love about it. This allows you to be able to do basically anything you want.
Yep.
For me, someone who travels, someone who has a trainer, someone, a personal trainer, mm-hmm. someone who loves my Peloton, someone who loves to get outside and bike.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm digging about it is that you have a personal coach that holds you accountable to those decisions that you make. They schedule things out for you. They basically say, okay, you're going to work out 4 times a week. That's what you want to do. They know what your goals are. Mm-hmm. And you can say, I really want to do my Peloton on Wednesday. Yep. And they hold you accountable to that. And you actually text with them. They FaceTime.
I did a TV show in Albuquerque. I had no weights. And so my boy, Matt, I said, look, I have nothing. And he created a workout for me that is body weight and things that I had around the house. Water jugs and
so
stuff.
So cool.
And it's unlimited personal training and they customize your workouts for a fixed cost. So you're not paying, you know, 70 here to do this class or 20 here to do this class. It's a fixed cost per month. Boom. You got everything at your fingertips.
An amazing price.
So if you're ready to invest in your long-term health and wellness, you can get started with your future coach right now with a 50% off your first 3 months at tryfuture.com/sibling. Again, that's tryfuture.com/sibling.
Angela Black, do you love watching a great mystery thriller?
I love watching. Kate, why are you asking me that? You know I like watching great mystery thrillers.
I've got the perfect one for you to watch next. Spectrum Originals, Angela Black. And you can binge all of the episodes for free on demand on Spectrum now.
In this new character-driven 6-part psychological thriller, we'll follow Angela Black, a woman whose reality is upended when she is approached by a mysterious man carrying an ominous warning.
Nothing is as it seems.
Nothing.
As she tries to save herself and her children from danger, leading Angela to doubt everything she thought she knew, including her own mind.
Ooh, she's going to lose her mind. Or she's going to question.
Sounds kind of fun.
Well, it stars Golden Globe winner Joanne Froggatt, who played Anna Bates in Downton Abbey.
I love her. And Mikhail Hussman from The Flight Attendant.
Right.
The show is perfect for fans who like a gripping mystery thriller like Gone Girl, Girl on the Train, The Undoing, Sharp Objects.
Mm. These are all very, very good actors. The minute I saw this trailer, I knew that it would be binge-worthy. I got 2 episodes in. I can't wait to start the third one. So I'm telling you, you have to start watching Angela Black today. Binge all of the episodes for free on demand on Spectrum. Now that's Spectrum Originals, Angela Black.
So you were born in New York, both of you.
I was born in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Clint
was born in L.A. Right?
For a reason. Clint was born in Burbank at St. Joe's Hospital there. My dad was in the Air Force at the time because his career was interrupted. Korean War was on. He was about to be drafted. Instead, he chose to enlist so that he could get into the you know, like sort of USO and do shows and special services and whatnot. And that's what he did. And instead of having me on the base hospital, at the base hospital, where very sadly she'd had a stillborn baby, a stillbirth the year before, and it certainly affected them deeply, she wanted to have me and Duncan with the family doctor. So that's why I never lived in Duncan, but I was born in her hometown. And once he got out of the Air Force, he went back into the acting. And because he had been on the road with Henry Fonda in the play Mr. Roberts for a year, he had a lot of authority, and he'd been on Broadway with it, had a lot of authority with Summer Stock Groups to direct that play and be in it. And so his career was going along well enough that he had that kind of opportunity. He did. And he started to see that I was picking up on the dialogue. I was mimicking. He thought that was hilarious. If you ever saw the movie, he took one of the scenes where he would play the Henry Fonda part and I would play the Jack Lemmon part. And we would do this scene for people and it would crack people up. And so.
And how old were you at this point?
Three.
My daughter's like that. She mimics. You can say to her, say it like this, Ronnie, and she'll just say it right back. She'll be like, you know.
Well, having directed a lot of kids now, I recognize that there is a thing. Some kids pick up on the notion of make-believe in a really organized way as something that you can do, mm-hmm. and people can get a kick out of it. And I've seen it. There are kids who are at three and four actually understand the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're organized enough to sort of be able to play along. Really kicks in by about five or six. But anyway, so he was making the rounds, which is a thing that actors in New York had to do. This is when all the television, live TV and everything was still in New York, 1958. And 57. And he wandered into a casting call where there were a lot of kids. He was just going to leave his picture and resume with the casting director who he kind of knew. And he said, well, they can't see you right now. We're swamped. We're doing this movie for MGM, The Journey. And he said, well, okay, I'll leave a note. And he left a note. Hey, Rance Howard stopped by. Hey, by the way, I have a son who's a fine actor. So... he was just hoping to make some kind of cut through somehow. Mm-hmm. So they called and said, why don't you bring your son in? And he said, well, I was kind of joking. They said, well, bring him in. So he did. And we did this scene for Mr. Roberts. And apparently it went over fairly well. And then they said, do you think he could do anything else? And my dad said, I honestly have no idea, but we could try.
Yeah.
And they gave him some sides and we went home and prepared and that worked out. And eventually then I had a screen test, which I write a lot about in the book because they did some kind of remarkable things to prepare me for the screen test.
This is so wild. I mean, it's also like when you're talking about it, just the romance of New York in the 50s, you know, and the how amazing that probably, what an amazing time that probably was.
They loved it. And my mom loved New York, late in her life, as she was coming to the end of her life, and she'd been ill for quite a while and had gone back into acting and had a great run as kind of the new little old lady on the block, you know, and she was just getting these sitcoms and these movie roles. And, you know, she just was working all the time. So she was getting a lot of validation there. Unfortunately, she was never very healthy and she sort of knew what was going on. And one of the things that she wanted to do was go back to New York and see New York again. So Dad took her back and she was in a wheelchair then. And they wanted to see the apartment where they had really, been those bohemian kids.
Yeah.
And
what was Irving Arms was the, I think
that might've been what it was called, the Irving Arms. And, you know, and they had sort of rented this
over by Gramercy Park.
No, it was on the Hudson and on the Upper West Side, like around 90th or something like that. And so they had great memories. They went from the hotel, they got in a cab, they went up there to see the place again. They pulled up And this is like, this is so much like a movie or a Charles Dickens novel.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a wrecking ball is swinging through the air, taking the building out.
Oh no.
And that's what I thought. I said, oh no. But here's my mom's vibe. I said, Mom, were you disappointed by that? And she said, Oh no. We felt really lucky. Lucky. Yeah. We felt really lucky that we got to be the last ones to see it.
Oh, wow. So that's who she was. I mean,
glass half full.
That's it
glass
right there.
It's also,
right.
I have to say, sort of who you are as a filmmaker. You must have carried that with you. You have that bittersweet hopefulness.
Well, thank you. I do view things, optimistically. But, talking about your pa, talking about Kurt, he's the one person, we've talked a lot about this over the years, that... that I view as somebody who really would understand our journey and the relationship, because your granddad, Bing,
mm-hmm. yeah.
he was very matter of fact about it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, here's a thing you can do.
Right.
Right. I mean, we used to talk about this, so I know I'm right. And yet conveying, if you look at Kurt's childhood performances, he was grounded. He was honest. Mm-hmm. He wasn't play acting. He understood the scene. This is a similar thing that Dad was able to do for Clint and I that allowed us to really learn the art of something, the tools that we could use the rest of our lives.
And mm-hmm. what's interesting is because we never really talk about Pa's as a childhood actor on our show. You know that's really like he started at 9. And he was a big Disney guy forever. Yeah.
But then he got fed up and quit the business. Pa.
Right. Right.
Moved to Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah. And
he was writing.
And was going to be a baseball player.
And was going to
yeah.
be. Yeah. Now,
well, that was after. Yeah.
Did you have that moment with acting and with being sort of known or seen where you were like, I'm not so sure this is.
No. All in. All in for all time. I mean, I thought about other things, like if I would have been good enough to be a baseball player, I thought I could maybe do that seasonally. When I was 8, they were saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? My pat answer was actor, writer, producer, director, cameraman, and baseball player.
In that order.
In that order, yeah.
So you're 5 years old. Mom gets pregnant with Clint.
Right.
What was your first kind of reaction to having a sibling? Did you know that it was going to be a boy? Probably not, right?
No, we didn't know in those days. You didn't ever know. I was thrilled. I was thrilled about it. I was kind of a lonely kid because, first of all, my first 2 years of my life, they were in the Air Force. So they were moving around. Then it's 2 years in... sort of in New York, but also summer stock. And then the thing, then we did this movie that was in Europe. And that's the first time that I acted professionally. So I knew kids here and there, but I didn't have a pal. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that. And I love my parents. We all got along fine, but I immediately was just enthralled with the idea of there being somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when Clint was born, do you have any of your earliest memories of him?
Yeah. The day we brought him home from the hospital.
Really?
What was that like?
Well, I had been on an audition that day and came back and to pick them up in their 52 Plymouth four-door sedan. And I just remember sitting in the back. And, they wheeled Mom out in the chair. It was St. Joseph's Hospital with this little bundle. Because I don't remember. I don't think I went to the hospital because I don't ever remember looking through the window and seeing babies or anything like that. And so here he was in this blanket. And my grandmother, my mom's mom, Louise Spiegel, she was there and she was helping her and just got in the back. And I, no seatbelts in those days, mm-mm. but no car seat.
No.
Just her holding her baby.
just mom holding her baby.
While driving.
And probably with cigarettes in their mouth.
Cigarette, martini, and driving.
and there was Clint. And, Clint was one of these kids. I remember it. I mean, I had personality from jump. I always say he was kind of born with one eyebrow raised and a smirk on his face.
Do you guys find that people know? Because Clint, you have one of the most recognizable faces as an actor, and you've been in everything, and you're hilarious, and you have memorable moments in a lot of the things.
Oh, my God. You're probably stopped on the street more than Ron. It's people, like, I know you.
Do people know that you're brothers?
Well, yes, I think the majority of people have figured it out one way or another. It's amazing to me when people don't know. Like, for instance, I believe, Ron, what show were we on? We were on the Today Show, where yes. The View, or we were on The View. And one of the ladies on The View said, I didn't know you guys were brothers. And I would think, Jesus, you know, I mean, I don't know.
I get it. I picked that up on the Twitter feed, though. But people also don't know that Bryce and I are related.
Yeah, like, I mean, I get the same thing with my brothers all the time. They're like, I had no idea that you guys, and it's like we do more things together. We post about each other all the time. But like between Wyatt, Ollie, and I, it's like nobody ever realizes we're related for some reason.
You know, the interesting thing about celebrity, being celebrity, is, you know, after a while, and listen, I don't remember when I wasn't. I don't remember when somebody was not looking at me, you know, really, really taking a look. And in fact, one thing that Mom said later in her life, right kind of towards the end, one thing she was really impressed by with me was that even as a very little kid, I could put blinders on. I could actually kind of focus on what I needed to focus on and not worry or be distracted by people looking at us. But that being said, the celebrity thing, I assume people know. People come up and approach me, you would think, well, they would know something about me. To what extent of their knowledge, I'm not sure, but they know something. And then when I find out what they know is completely wrong,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, which I get a kick out of that. When people claim they know stuff about me, it's just not even close. Where do you get your information? You know, but it's always, I have to gauge, well, okay, this person, is he just full of it?
Yeah.
Is he just, what is he? What is he trying to get something from
me? Oh, well, always.
Well,
I
you
mean,
also we, have that is when you're growing up with a famous parent.
Right. We've experienced that too. And I'm sure your kids have as well, though.
It's also a little opposite where it's more like you do gauge the bullshitters really early on because you see how they're reacting to your parent. Like for me with Mom and Pa, mm-hmm. I have the opposite. There's no blinder. It's like I've got like vampire vision. Like I can see everything happening.
Yeah. Yeah,
I can see who's coming in. Right. I know that immediately they're going to want to talk to Pa. Sure. They're going to talk to Mom. Oh, yeah. I see Mom
your
left her glasses.
Are crazy heightened.
Yeah, it's like.
But you also get sharp. You know, you get sharp on who people are and mm-hmm. their intentions, and your intuition just goes boom. I mean, I think it's really a growing experience.
I think my bullshit detector has been, you know, really refined and, you know, honed pretty well. I can miss. I miss it. I miss my BS detector misses, but I think you're right. I generally speaking,
Do you guys as sibs, do you think does it pull you together as sibs?
Yes.
Yeah. 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 No, I think it does for sure. You know, I mean,
I sort of feel that with my kids. We have four kids. Two of them are in the business, two not, but I feel like they're super close because we've traveled around and it was always a little bit of a circus.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of drew them together. I had a problem with it. I hated when people came up to Mom. It drove me crazy. I remember as a young boy feeling anger, not expressing it because I was too little, but being angry when someone would come up to my parents. Like it was just this really sort of instinctive, And then as I got older, I did everything that I could to keep it quiet and secret who my parents were. I mean, everything that I could. Actually, a quick funny story about Katie and I at camp. We were at Four Winds Westward Ho on Orcas Island, really a great sailing camp.
This is a funny story.
I didn't want anyone to fucking know who my parents were because I wanted to be anonymous.
Ollie's like, don't ever tell anybody.
I wanted them to like me for me. I mean, it was a whole thing. I was 11 or 12 years old.
Cut to...
there's this huge lawn that we have these all camp sort of what it's like a
assembly,
like an assembly,
and it's like a runway that goes down into the water.
Down right,
and
there's very a big beautiful
dock, and it's Orcas Island, yeah, it's Seattle. Beautiful. It's gorgeous, and there's this dock, and a schooner on the dock.
Yeah, and the camp counselor's like giving his announcement. All of a sudden, the seaplane goes.
It buzzes our assembly.
Buzzes down the assembly and does this big left-hand turn and distracts everyone.
And everyone's looking up.
We're like, what the hell?
And then looking up.
And the seaplane lands and pulls up to the dock right at the bottom of the assembly. Out steps our fucking mother. Blonde hair.
I mean, Goldie Hawn in all her glory. Ron, she was literally like,
Hi! Oh like, God. I'm looking for my kids.
And she runs up the thing, and Oliver was like,
I was like, oh my God.
And I, of course,
kill
was
myself.
Very happy. I was like,
Mommy! What a great story. Well, four kids, there was one of the daughters, would just, it was really dad. leave me off here.
Yeah, don't come in.
500 yards from the check-in, and turn around. And I love you, but goodbye.
Did you guys growing up though? Because you did have fame at an early age. Were you ever? Were you annoyed with it? You know, and was it ever like Jesus? Yes. I love what I do.
No, I was. I never loved that. Never loved that. I'm an introvert. I love the work. Always loved it. Loved the set. Caught on to the idea that there was this creative energy, and there was a lot of laughs, and there was, and as a kid, you could actually earn their respect, real honest respect. You could even be, you could be a peer almost, and I loved everything about that. But, the world away from the studio was a little perplexing for me. Clint went through it very differently. He had a kind of a, like he talked about those blinders. He just a very unselfconscious, confident kid. And it was like, if somebody fucked with him, it didn't throw him. He was like, game on.
Did you embrace that more? Like, yeah, fuck it. This is who I am. And let me put my chest out a little bit and I'm good with that.
Well, yeah. I did. I did embrace it more, but I also had the great advantage of watching him navigate, and run into a lot of spitballs and a lot of water balloons. I mean, not literally, but, Ron put up with a lot of crap.
Yeah.
And I was just smart enough. It was hopefully just smart enough to be able to sort of identify, well, wait, if you zig here, if you kind of act this way, then they won't pick on you. Listen, Ron grew up, he was the first kid, and he was, he was kind of a nerd. He really was, I mean, I love Ron dearly.
You're putting that in the past tense. I have a feeling it's still in my hole.
No, you're not much of a nerd. You're not much of a nerd anymore, dude. No, I just, so I had the position of being able to watch him. Listen, what a great advantage. Being able to see my 5-year older brother navigate through these tricky waters of the entertainment business, and forget the entertainment business, but life. How to deal with the public, how to deal with people when they came up and said, Gentle Ben, where's your bear? And Opie and stuff. I mean, it just was, I don't recall ever not having that, and never not.
Well, I had to learn how to handwrite to do autographs, to give autographs.
Right. You ever get in any fights with kids? Like, fuck you, bang.
Yeah.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah. I was bullied around, and dad was a tough guy. He wasn't he wasn't aggressive. He didn't ever seek conflict, but he was, he was a strapping farm boy, and he'd wanted to be a boxer. I don't think he ever feared anybody or anything really in his life. He was just one of these guys in a calm, cool kind of, sort of Midwestern Zen way. But so he would just say, punch him in the nose. Well, I didn't quite ever get around to punching too many people in the nose. We were very good at wrestling in our family. Wrestling was a big thing in the 60s, very popular. And we used to play act, all that stuff. And Clint, when Clint came along, he joined in right away. But I actually, because of this, If they said you want to fight, it never was punching anyway. It was always sort of tackling and grappling. And I was good at that. And so I kind of had to earn my way. My dad knew nothing about sports, but the reason that I became a middling athlete, it was that I needed it as an equalizer. And I practiced, man. I mean, on my own in ways that my buddies wouldn't bother to do. Just to get so, if I was in a pickup basketball game, they had to deal with me. I was pretty good. Baseball, I'd make the team.
Earned your respect, sort of, even though, I mean, everyone would want to be in your position on TV making that kind of dough. But at the same time, that's looked down upon when you're a kid.
Yeah, right? That's right.
You earn your respect through athletics and being like, oh, wait, holy shit, this kid's actually can play ball.
He can handle himself on the playground.
I think sometimes for like millennials or Gen Zs forget that television, what the kind of stardom it created not that long ago, but really when you were on that show, there were only so many channels.
That's right. Three channels.
And there were only so many shows. I mean, you were really America's child star. I mean, people tuned in and it's like being a Beatle. I mean, I don't want to compare you to a Beatle.
He was like Justin Bieber of his day.
You're like a beat.
That happened to Henry Winkler. That actually happened to Henry Winkler with Happy Days. And that was a different kind of a thing. But but there was an absolute familiarity that was, unlike anything that would really happen today to a kid actor. And the show was a top 10 show for 8 years. In fact, it was the number one show in the nation. The last year that it was on the air, but Andy Griffith was just tired of doing it, wanted to try something else.
Now you're a success if you have, 2.5 million people watching your show. When you were a kid, how many people were watching that show?
If you didn't hit 30 million, it was an off week.
Yeah. Fucking crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. Yeah. So what did you do?
I did. So Everly Well, before we talk about Everly Well, the idea is what if you could use science, right, to discover more about your body all year long? You give yourself more clarity, better understanding of your health and your wellness with Everly Well at-home lab tests. So this is an at-home lab test where you can just monitor.
What did you do?
Okay, so I did foods.
Oh, I did my thyroid.
I want to do foods because I never do. I just have no idea what I may or may not be allergic to, what doesn't settle well with me.
Well, let's talk about what the at-home lab tests give you. So they give you physician-reviewed results, personal insights so that you can take action on your health and wellness at an affordable and transparent cost. So there's 30 tests. You're able to choose the ones that make the most sense for you. So food sensitivity is like what you did. Metabolism, that was the other thing.
I think I'm going to do metabolism next.
Yeah. Sleep and stress and thyroid are just a few of the many options.
They ship you your at-home test straight to your house with everything you need for a simple sample collection. You use the prepaid shipping label, you mail your test back to a certified lab, and in just days, your physician-reviewed results and actionable insights are sent to your device. Everything is digital, and you can share the results with your primary care physician to help guide the next steps. And for listeners of our show, Everly Well is offering a special discount of 20% off an at-home lab test at everlywell.com/sibling. That is everlywell.com/sibling for 20% off your at-home lab test. everlywell.com/sibling. We're back, baby, with Coors Light. They will never leave us. We will never leave them. We are a unit. Coors Light is basically half my blood. I have half blood red platelets and then half Coors Light.
Oh, my God.
Are you ready to chill?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready to chill. Do you want to hit a reset button and get ready for what's next?
Fuck yes.
Yeah. Because these days, everything is go, 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 go. Right?
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, for me.
It is for me, too.
Yeah, so it's time to take a pause. Okay. And it's time to drink a cold, refreshing Coors Light.
Oh, that sounds so good.
I know, it does. And we're in LA right now, and it makes me nostalgic even talking about Coors Light.
I know. Well, you're about to go up there. You're going to get up there
That's
soon.
That's right. I am.
You're going to be up there
get
soon.
My ski. Get my ski on.
Coors. It's cold lagered, cold filtered, cold packaged. It is literally, Oliver, made to chill.
And it's as crisp and as refreshing as the Colorado Rockies themselves.
Woo!
Yeah.
Get me up and those Rockies.
So Coors Light is the one that we choose when we need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that is made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart by going to CoorsLight.com/Hudson.
Were you protective of each other when you were younger?
I didn't have to protect him. He was a good young athlete, terrific actor, funny, made friends easily. I admired Clint. I thought he was cool. I was proud of him, really proud of him. He never got picked on by anybody. And so I didn't have to protect him. And Dad was a protector. You know, he's a freelance actor. He wasn't on a series. You know, he worked 2 days here, a day there, and a week there. And so he was around. And also a very protective family. I mean, we hung in the neighborhood. By today's standards, we had a lot of freedom. But for those standards, we were held very close in our little bubble. Yeah, we had pals, and yes, we could run the neighborhood to an extent, but not the way everybody else could. But he made me feel safe wherever I was, on a set or anywhere else.
Did you guys have lulls in your relationship? You know what I mean? Like moving forward in your life where you didn't talk for a while. Kate and I were just having this to talk, yeah. You know. She went and worked in Europe for 5 months and I was doing my thing. And sometimes you don't talk for months and months
at a time.
Yeah,
I mean, in our 20s, we hardly talked for years.
Yeah, in our 20s, that we barely even spoke.
We would like see each other, but...
Well, I mean, we have stayed close over the years, but we live on Clint lives on the West Coast. I live on the East Coast, you know, and this year I've only been in the United States 2 weeks. This book, in fact, has been a kind of a gift. And I've thought about it. I thought, well, mom and dad, they wanted us to be close. They'd love that we did this book. And, this is not any sort of, reuniting, but definitely it's been great for these 2 years to have a project to work on and a reason to get on the phone and be sharing emails and talking back and forth. Don't you think, Clint?
And the reminiscing too, right? Clint, just like you get to relive it again, which is probably painful and beautiful all at the same time, you know?
Yeah. But listen, I tell you what, I dwell more on the fact that, you know, we were a New York Times bestseller for a month. Mm-hmm. I'm proud. I'm proud that Ron and I could collaborate and do something that, you know, affects people. We're getting, you know, wonderful reviews and friends and people just, you know, they heartfelt response. Let me double back. I was as best as I could being 5 years younger. I was to the best of my ability protective of Ron. He went through, you know, being Opie, when you're like 15 years old or 16 years old and having been Opie for the better part of a decade, that's shitty, you know. Now, granted, the work wasn't, and I know it was a beautiful experience. And I met Andy and Don and all these beautiful people got together and created this great show. But Ron was left as a teenager with acne being, hey, Opie, Opie, Dopey, you know,
gnarly.
You know, and even through Happy Days, it was like I don't know, just maybe cosmically or whatever I could do. I was just, you know, I believed him as a director. I believed when he was 15 years old and I was 10. I looked around and said, shit, this guy's as good as anybody right now. And he's 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Imagine if he has a little experience under his belt. I never doubted for a second that he could do it. And I supported him, you know, as best as I could, with as much positive sort of, you know, I mean, I got past the peeing on him part.
Wow, he did.
Wait a minute.
Did that too. Oliver did that to me once.
Yeah, but I have not gotten past it. So
what? Oliver.
He still likes to pee on your sister. On me to get to,
it, oh yeah.
Well, it was we shared a bathroom, and so I was a very aggressive young girl who was like, "Get out! Come on, I need the bathroom." And I just walk in, and then that was the way he deterred me.
I turn around
and start peeing everywhere.
Well, in our situation, Clint was about 18 months old, still in diapers, still those last stages of diapers. And I remember being down on the floor playing with Lincoln Logs or something, and all of a sudden I feel this warm stream hitting my cheek. And I'm hearing this sort of chortling little laugh. And I look over, Clint has stripped off his diaper, is leaning pelvis forward with his arms in the air, which is where I gave him the nick. From then on, he was the hee-hee man, as far as I was concerned.
Oh, my God.
I just did it once. I swear to God.
You know, one of the things that really struck me in the book was about your parents and the handling actually of the finances, and that, and it was like, that's such a rare thing for child actors or young kids who are pop stars, that the parents actually are saving that money for their children. Yeah. They knew it was yours to be earned.
Yeah. I think you had the perfect parents to orchestrate it that way, because they were the bohemians, they were the artists, and they understood hard work, and your dad was a journeyman actor. You know, it's like, oh, okay, you know, I'm not going to fucking steal.
They had values. You know,
they had values. And I think the fact that very quickly I was getting more work than he was, he wasn't going to abandon his career ever. But I also think as a point of pride, we were going to, by God, live on his paycheck. And he was never going to put his son or sons in the situation where they were in any way the breadwinners. This was their household. This was their family. In fact, when Cheryl and I started having kids, he said, "I've only got one piece of advice for you guys. You know, be loving, but it's not the kids' home. Don't let them run the show. They need you to be the parent. They need you to define what your household is going to be." And, you know, I immediately recognized that that's what he did. But that also entailed saving our money. Because he, you know, I mean, they took a manager's fee. You guys know what manager's fees are. They're usually 15%.
Yeah, they're usually 5%.
5%.
I was like, that's what I'm saying. This is like the most amazing, emotional, best managers ever.
Yeah.
I want to just jump a little bit ahead to like the days that you guys are both kind of like killing it as actors. You're young. Did you party? Like, were there moments where you guys were like, we're going to like cash in tonight on our fame and we're going to party?
I never partied with Ron.
I'm saying, did you guys ever have those moments together?
But listen, I am not a partier. I mean, I'm just not, and it's not in my DNA, I'm not comfortable in those situations. It's not fun for me. And college, you know, sure, you know, cut loose a little bit, you know, some drunken somersaults down the hall at Trojan Hall and at USC, sure, a little bit, but not fun. The next day, it was like, why did I do somersaults down the fucking hall? I don't want to do somersaults down the fucking hall. That was not funny.
You know, we didn't go shopping on Rodeo Drive. We didn't go, we never, you know, mom and dad set up our lives. You know, we were dressed from Sears, you know, Sears catalog. And, you know, I know I had one suit, you know, we didn't live like we were going to a party. That was just not set up. We were the Howards. We, you know.
And they weren't very social. I mean, they weren't like socially ambitious. You know, at all. they had friends and pals, and there were parties and so forth. But I never saw any of the other kid actors. Unless I was working with one of them on a show or crossing, you know, sitting across from them at an audition, you know, we had really bifurcated lives. It was work, which we understood and liked, and then it was literally Burbank, California, and the Parks and Recreation Department and school, and those were our lives.
Both of you, just it's a very interesting dynamic because it's very different and opposite than what most people would think would happen when you're growing up. What was your first job, Clint? How old were you?
Well, I did an episode of the Andy Griffith Show when I was 2 years old, and in fact, I'm a few days shy of being 60 years in the industry, paid professional.
That is, have you been a SAG member for 60 years?
No, because back in 1961, infants and kids didn't have to join SAG. I don't think I joined SAG until 1964 or 65.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm still like 16,000. I don't know what your number is, Ron, but my number is like 16,000. Dad's number, remarkably, was like 2,300, because it goes by seniority.
There was a
woman, an actress who was number one. I think James Cagney was like number two or three, but it went by whoever joined.
Have you directed Clint, meaning in one of your movies, Ron, in one of your movies, or meant multiple of your movies?
Yes, many times. Apollo 13 is probably one of Clint's bigger roles, but also The Paper. I don't know. How many movies do you think, Clint? 10, 11, 12?
I can count the ones that I wasn't in. I'll tell you that.
I mean, are there times where Clint's like, Ron, fucking put me in this movie?
You're like, that would have been the right part.
Clint says it, but he gives me the look. I love working with him. He's great. He just elevates every scene he's in. He's creative. He also knows his way around. He's no muss, no fuss. Everything you could dream of. So additive. But I never put him in just to put him in.
Right. It's got to be right.
If he can score and there's something really to do then I love having
it. That's how I feel about Ollie.
Guys, hold on. Hold on. The one I wanted to be in Heart of the Sea,
yeah,
his whaling movie.
God, I love that book.
I just couldn't drop the weight. I couldn't play dying skinny.
Yeah. Right.
I wanted to be on that lifeboat.
But it entailed not eating for 3 months.
Far and away, Clint, there's this scene where they're claiming the land.
Tell me you like my hat, Charlie.
And Nicole Kidman is like up on that hill and her like perfect hair is like this. And then she gets on the horse and she, I remember when I was seeing that when I was little and I was like, I will be running on a horse one day on film. it was like this is the image I see and that I want to be as an actress.
Well, that's fantastic.
I'm also bummed out I wasn't in that too.
Well, Clint was in that one. He actually had a funny part. In fact, didn't Nicole punch you or push you down or something in that movie?
Yeah, she pushed me into a big vat of feathers. Because I was the foreman of the chicken plucking.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, my God.
Wait, has Ron made you audition ever?
Oh, yeah. I auditioned until about 1984. And then it was Ron hired me in Backdraft. And my scene was with Robert De Niro. And Ron, you know, I know you told me this, that Brian, your partner, came up and said, don't you think we ought to maybe audition him or something? And then once Brian saw my performance in Backdraft, he said to you, your brother doesn't have to audition anymore.
That's great.
You know. But back to Far and Away, I just want to say one thing about that. You know, very, you know, romantic, idealized, rose-colored glasses look back at the, you know, at that period of history. And just, it's not exactly a full-on comedy, but it's definitely a romance. It was a blast to do. I loved working with them. But the land race scene, which was epic to do, was really meaningful to me because we had three ancestors who rode in that race.
Wow.
And nobody got anything. But that's why I was always fascinated by that event, which you now look at and realize, well, they took the land from the Native Americans and yeah. the railroad, you know, wanted people in there and they gave it away to the Anglos. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a dubious page mm-hmm. in our history, but it meant something in our family history. And on the day that we were filming that scene, I remember we had 13 cameras. We had all of these 750 extras and horses and what, and including my father, which I'll get to in a second. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell a story that's not in the book because it came after the period of time that we were covering in the book. And I was on a camber crane booming up and I looking out and it was dawn. And I said, oh my, this is as close to a time machine as anyone could ever experience because my relatives were there. They were feeling this anxiety, you know, 100 years ago. It was wild. But speaking of that 100 years, my dad was in that movie and a really good horseman. And he was going to ride it. You know, his character was supposed to race. And we did 3 runs at this thing. And with all these 700 people and horses lined up, the head wrangler and stunt coordinator, Walter, came up to me and he said, you know, in the first one, we're not having any principals ride because we don't know exactly what's going to happen with this thing. And, you know, and your dad's a good horseman. He's bona fide, but he was 66 years old at this time, 67. He's a good horseman, but he wants to ride in this shot. And I keep telling him, Rance, they're all wide angles. It's no reason for you to do that. We're not letting any actors do it. And please tell him because I don't feel safe about this. And so I went up to Dad and I said, Dad, Walter's the man here on this. You know, we're not going to have a camera on you. There's just no reason for you to do it. The next go, I'm going to have crews in there with Nicole and you, and I have cameras for you guys. And he said, I said, oh, so you just sit out the first one. And I started to walk away and he said, son, and he almost never hit me with that one. And it was just like a movie. I turned around. He kind of waved for me to walk back over there. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, 100 years ago, I had 3 ancestors who rode in this thing. 100 years later, my son is directing a movie about it. And I'd like to ride in the shot. And I turned to Walter and I said, get him his horse.
Yeah.
Get him his
horse.
Oh, man. That's just the best.
Let me, just like an esoteric question because, you know, I'm an actor, but directing is something that I've done since I was a kid. When she was acting as a infant, I was in 5th grade making movies.
Right.
Went to college, blah, blah, blah. Needed to make money, became an actor. But, you know, directing is something that is a passion of mine, a passion that I don't really pursue because I'm mm-hmm. constantly trying to support a family. And it gets overwhelming, honestly. Yeah. The process is overwhelming for right now in my life. But a bigger question, like, what do you feel when you are making a movie? Like, what is that emotion? Not necessarily in conjunction with the story, but just overall, you know?
I feel a kind of a, I mean, it varies because it's shifting. But the biggest thing that I noticed was that I was less tired at the end of a day of directing than I was in any day where I had like sizable work to do as an actor. That the elevator ride of did it and the self-doubt and did I get it? And I wish they would have given me another one it was far more exhausting emotionally getting there and back than directing where you step on a set, you've prepared everything and your focus and your energy level immediately just zooms. If you've got, you know, to a 9.7. And with the first questions coming in and it never stops. It's like that kind of all you're sort of between 8.5 and 9.7 all day long. And that's the energy level. So it's really focused. But when things start to go well, it can be really, by the way, it makes you feel stupid because you inevitably make a lot of bad calls every day. A lot of little mistakes that eat up time that, you know, and I'm always for trying to be as efficient as possible because I want to create space. I want to create space in the schedule for the good idea, for the go back, for the actor wants to try it another way, for all of those things. And so I try to be very, very efficient while also creating an environment where the key people can feel like they're, you know, that they've been given a shot to do their best work. I wanted to create that environment every day on behalf of the story. And there are times when there is definitely a feeling of a flow. There's a time, there are times when you are saying, we're moving to this setup over to here. And by the way, talk to the actor, remind them of such and such, turn around to the DP. Don't forget, we got to, you know, let's switch the lens. And it can be really thrilling because the machine starts to work around that little goal, which is going to be the moment you're trying to get. It's thrilling. I find it thrilling. I still find it thrilling. I just finished doing a movie and it was hard work, but I sort of rewarded every so often every day when you hit those moments and a problem gets solved and something good gets, you know.
Are you doing your post in London too?
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah. Okay. We shot in Australia and we're doing post in
London. I see. Okay.
What about your ego? Now, it's a weird question because you seem like the least egotistical man of all time. But when you become successful and more, do you ever have to check your ego? Meaning like, I am the shit. I know I'm the shit. Everyone knows I'm the shit. I've made incredible movies. And
Oliver, I don't think Ron Howard sees himself like that.
I think he does.
I have a feeling. Sometimes I feel it manifests itself differently.
I wish I would allow myself that a little bit more.
Really?
I need to get your phone call and you need to cheerlead me, man.
You're going to be like, Ollie, give me some of that.
Ron, you're the shit.
Right at this moment, I am not the shit. I am shit.
Right.
I know that feeling. I feel like I have that at least once a day when I'm working. You know, Clint, we're going to start wrapping up here, but I really do want to hit on, you know, your struggles with addiction. And I just think that's a really like wonderful, honest thing for you to do. And so helpful for so many people. I know we have so many friends who struggle. And I just wanted to sort of ask if talking about that and letting that out was a very healing process for you and how you feel about it now that you were able to sort of just be, you know, as open as you were about it in the book.
Well, the healing began, you know, in really 1991. I mean, and listen, I got to be careful about anonymity and stuff, but you know, there are programs where people gather and they share their experience, strength, and hope. And you know, I have shared my story umpteen times, hundreds of times. I did a lot of speaking and stuff. I've laid my cards out on the table before. I didn't find it much different laying my cards on the table in writing this book. You know, listen, I just had a penchant. That's not quite the right word. I liked the feeling of being high. I mean, I just did. And, you know, I think to some degree, I still do. I still sort of try to chase euphoria to a degree. I don't know whether it's in my DNA or whether it's something that came about or something. But, you know, I was so anxious to smoke weed when I was about 13 years old, maybe 14 years old. I mean, I can't quite remember that I took the pencil shavings of my pencil sharpener and I twisted up a fatty and I tried to smoke the pencil shavings. Now, you know, somewhere in my head, I knew it wasn't going to work, but I was just so anxious to try to get there, you know, and that, I don't know, it wasn't learned behavior. I don't think me being in the business had anything to do with it. It's just, it was sort of in, like I said, it was in my DNA. And, you know, sharing is critical. You know, you're only as sick as your secrets. You really, and you know, and I didn't, this book is not meant to be some sort of revelatory thing because like I said, I've spoken about this stuff a lot, and you know, with my friends and my family. Ron knows. Ron was right there with me. And Ron drove a couple of times to rehabs to visit me and stuff, you know? And you know, it just felt like as far as, you know, as we wrote The Boys, It did happen in my childhood. You know, I did start getting loaded in my childhood.
How old?
It was something that we needed to talk about. You know, I started getting loaded, you know, when I was about 16 years old, sort of on a daily basis. You know, I played high school baseball. I was a varsity high school player and I smoked weed and drank. You know, there was a period of time where it sort of worked, where I was able to anesthetize myself and everything was great. And then, you know, like what happens with most people with addiction and drug abuse or alcoholism is it quit working, you know? And, I'm in a way, I'm really glad that it did quit working because Jesus, you know, my liver would be out to here now. It's been, mm-hmm. you know, so anyway, I am always grateful to be given an opportunity to share and to talk and one-on-one with somebody who's struggling or in some sort of a group session. I certainly know that, you know, honesty is the best policy. And you know, if it, like you said, if I can do something to help somebody, Jesus, that's, you know, that's kind of why I'm on earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you have to go through sort of analysis, meaning self-analysis, just to understand why and where this came from in order to sort of curtail this addiction and come out of it?
Oh, I don't know. You know what? Back in 1991, I mean, my first run at recovery was 1984. And then I had another, I'm 88. You know, I hit bedrock. I hit rock bottom and then skidded along the bedrock for a mm-hmm. while, you know. No, you know what? Simply enough, friggin', I put the plug in the jug and I started taking suggestions of other people. I remember the first time I saw the 12 steps of recovery. I thought these are great, but they need to edit them down a little bit because there's 12 too many.
Too many.
Maybe they ought to edit it down to 5 steps. But in 1991, I said, Clint, fucking please, let's try to do it their way. You know, and I had success. With not a lot of analysis. Of course I did inventories and of course I worked through things, but I like to get loaded and it's time to stop.
Yeah.
I like the straightforward aspect of that. You know, I mean, it's pretty straightforward and it.
Right. Maybe it doesn't have to be anything from your child. It's like,
yeah. Well, he made his mom and dad happy, proud people when they both, you know, they both saw it and it made their lives. It made their lives to see him go through that and come out of it the way he
has. Before we end, I just want to say that the documentary Your Girl Did Dads was just so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
I even contacted some of the subjects via Instagram just to sort of communicate because I was so
excellent.
I was just so amazed by their stories. And it's my number one priority in my life over my career, over anything else. Being a father is extremely important to me because our dad sort of wasn't there and we wanted to break the cycle. I wanted to break the cycle. So watching that was just really powerful and how you were raised and how you raised your kids and how you had a video camera in your hand seemingly all the time filming everything. Well, you're very inspirational as a dad too.
Well, thank you. I'll pass that along to Bryce, who's also here in London working.
And is your boy still playing golf?
Oh, yeah.
Golf. Yes. Reed is still playing and he also has a teaching tool called Steadhead, which is selling, and he you know patented this thing, and he's doing that as well.
Great.
Well, before we go, we're gonna do a quick speed round, and I guess the first question I'm gonna start the speed round with is, what did this book in like a quick sentence? What did this book? What's a new thing that it taught you about your brother? And you guys can both answer it.
It reminded me of how funny Clint is, but it taught me that even as a young guy, he was wise to the world and competitive, and more competitive than I realized he was.
Well, listen, it reaffirmed in my mind what a frigging awesome man my big brother is. You know, he's consistent. He was consistent when I was 5 and he was 10, he was consistent. He's consistent all through our adult lives. He's been a very consistent presence in my life. And, you know, I love that consistency. He's a Hall of Fame guy. And in the sports world, there was a ball player, Carl Yastrzemski, just year in and year out, just banged it out. One year he had the Triple Crown. You know, one year the Red Sox won, but day in and day out, Yastrzemski, you know, brought his lunch pail to the yard and played ball. And that's Ron.
Aww. Awesome.
I love that. So, okay, what was the best advice you've received from the other?
Wow. Can you go, Clint? Do you have anything? Best advice.
Well, okay, the best advice I ever is Ron, in adulthood, Ron would start a lot of sentences by a lot of conversations by saying, "Now, Clint, I'm going to give you some unsolicited advice." But, you know, it's the consistency of the advice. It's all really solid. And another thing that Ron has done, which I really appreciate, he has dropped tidbits of advice that he has gained from other people, people that he has respected, both in the industry and out of the industry. Ron likes to pass along. Ron likes to share, you know, and you know, he's told me things, little insights that George Lucas has told him. George and Ron have been, you know, very much close over the years. And it just seems like right when I needed to hear something, Ron would, you know, say something. Oh, you know, I heard this from George Lucas, or, you know, and not to name drop, but listen, George is a very successful guy. Mm-hmm. And listen, you know, his advice seems pretty solid to me. So anyway, it's Ron imparts just the right stuff at just the right time.
And Clint's got a great clear-eyed sense of the world. I think some of it has to do with everything that he's lived through and accomplished away from the set as much as you know, working on movies or television shows. But for him, it's a sort of a clear, he has a sense that he will try to impart to me, to trust my gut, give it my best shot, and live with it. And, you know, kind of stop thinking you're going to be able to control the outcome.
Mm-hmm. I
just
like that.
Do your thing.
Yeah.
And I think that there have been many times when he's seen me, you know, sort of straining, struggling with an idea, feeling, emotion. And I'll call him up because he has that wisdom and can give that kind of advice.
Here's one. Who's more athletic?
Clint. Oh.
He just raises his hand.
Yeah. Clint, great with the hand-eye coordination. Decides to pick up a ping pong table, and before long, he's down there playing with the people on their way to the Olympics.
First childhood crush.
For me, it was a girl that I was acting with in a movie at Disney, and she recently passed away. Her name was Donna Butterworth. She was a singer. She'd done a movie, an Elvis movie, and we were in this TV movie together. And we got to do a publicity trip to Disneyland at one point, and we kissed on the Monsanto ride.
Oh. Donna Butterworth. Clint?
Well,
he's like Donna,
you know,
Butterworth.
She lived across the street from me on Cordova, and her name was Paulette Fraconi.
Ah, an Italian.
But also too, and I write about this in The Boys, you know, a director that we were really close with, Bob Totten, had a daughter named Heather, and Heather had red hair. And I was, you know, Heather and I actually had a little, you know, 12-year-old relationship when, you know, about the time I was making The Red Pony. So Heather Totten, Heather Totten and Paulette Fraconi.
Hey, did mom and dad have a favorite? And I mean that, of course they didn't, but were there times where you're like, oh no, of course, Clint's the man, or Ron is the man?
They were pretty balanced.
They were
pretty balanced about that. And again, there was that distance.
Yeah.
So he was the baby, you know, and entertaining as hell and talented. But I never felt like that I was being superseded by the kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
The last question, we do this with everybody, is if there is, it's a two-part question. If there is one thing that you could emulate from your brother, what would that be? And then the other part of the question is, if there is something that you could alleviate from your brother that you feel could help them in their life and sort of optimize their life, what would that be?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, it really is simple. First of all, the thing that Ron needs to take a break every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Ron is a determined, dogged, hardworking man, very focused. And you know, like I used to play a lot of golf, and you know, I would make this statement. I would say, you know, while Ron is trying to learn how to make a better motion picture, I'm learning how to hit a 4-iron out of the rough.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And that sort of encapsulated it very much. I'll tell you, Ron may not be an absolute genius. I mean, I love him dearly, but he may not be an absolute genius. But what he is genius at doing is staying on a problem and working it. Ron is forever putting his maximum brain power onto a situation and getting optimum results. Obviously, the proof is in the pudding. He's got great kids. He's had a tremendously successful career. He's been married for a zillion years to this beautiful girl that he met in high school. You know, Ron has done things right, and he does it not with genius, but with focus. And that's something I'd like to have a little more of.
And what would you alleviate from him? Something.
There's a break.
Oh, sorry.
Take a break.
Just take a break.
He said take a break.
Oh, yeah. Listen, the other one. Okay.
Do you want to alleviate that from me?
Ron hit the jackpot as a filmmaker in his mid-20s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeded to like go 10 years without taking a family vacation.
Right.
Oh, my God. Ron. I have a feeling there were family vacations. They were just happening where he was shooting.
Right.
I was at one of them.
Ron, wait, hold on. Hold on a second. I would be on the phone with Ron and he would be off on some little 2 or 3 day break. This was later on because he really did go years without taking a family vacation, but he had promised Cheryl that he wouldn't bring any scripts with him. He promised Cheryl that he wasn't going to work on anything show business related, but yet he would confide in me that he brought a couple of scripts.
And just
otherwise
for...
I'd be jonesing and no good to anybody. So let's see, Clint. I wish I could have Clint's sort of ability to own and be himself with a complete sense that's more than enough.
Mm.
And you know, Clint doesn't feel like he has to please people. He's not a guy going around annoying people or like creating problems, but he's present with himself in the situation in that moment with a strong measure of confidence. And I admire that. I wish I had a little bit more of that. Sure, I'm confident. I mean, I know I've had, you know, success, and I have confidence in my ideas and my thoughts. But it's that sort of real centered stability that, you know, that I'm enough. You know, and more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Clint has that, and I admire that in him. And because it's you know, and with that is I think more relaxation and a sense to have more fun, more laughs, and be a little bit looser, which is great. The thing that I wish I could give him is wow, I think he's doing pretty damn well. I wish I could give him back some of the time that he did lose.
Mm.
Because he went through a rough decade, and by the same token, he wouldn't be who he is today without having lived through that. And we as a family benefit from that, benefit from his wisdom, his insights. But he lost time, and he knows it. And, you know, if I could wave a wand, you know, I would try to give that back to him, but I wouldn't change him. There's nothing I don't think I can improve him.
Love that.
Well, that's I love so this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Pleasure.
This was so wonderful.
Talk to you both.
I appreciate you guys.
We'll see. Yeah, this was so great. I loved it so much. We'll see you soon.
And get the book.
Okay. Yeah. The Boys, a memoir.
The Boys.
Yes, there you go. All right.
All right, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Sibling Revelry is executive produced by Kate Hudson and Oliver Hudson.
Producer is Allison Bresnik.
Editor is Josh Windisch.
Music by Mark Hudson, a.k.a. Uncle Mark.
If you want to show us some love, rate the show and leave us a review. This show is powered by Simplecast.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.